that's still good morning by our clock.
Council, ready to proceed?
May I please the court, Amy Brown, Morgan Sullivan, on behalf of Barbara Chaplin, the appellee. At this time, I'd like to introduce to the court Jennifer Dubois James, who has been admitted for probation.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, for the record, David Finger for the appellant H. Beatty Chadwick. There are three issues before the court in this appeal. One is the scope of Section 3104C3 of the long-arm statute relating to causing tortious injury in Delaware by an act in Delaware. The second is the applicability of the McWane first filed rule. And the third is the applicability of the libel proof plaintiff doctrine. And with the court's permission, I will take those issues in that order.
That's fine. But if in fact your opponents prevail on McWane, we don't have to reach the other two issues, do we?
I imagine that's correct, Your Honor. McWane was applied in that case only to MetroCorp, who was the only remaining defendant.
I knew that's what the ruling was, although the briefs seem to suggest that we don't need a complete unity of parties in both suits, and that because of the substantial similarity, according to your opponents in these suits, that McWane would apply to everyone.
I believe that is a correct statement of their position, Your Honor, although I still don't want to put words in their mouth. But since Your Honor has made this point, I will turn to McWane first. I would like to begin the McWane argument with a hypothetical, which I think will help explain our position. A man is walking across the street when he's struck by a car, a blue Ford Taurus. He's injured and files suit. The suit drags on for years. 6 years later, while the suit is still pending, the man is crossing the same street when he's struck by the same person, still driving a Ford Taurus, maybe even the same one. Only now it's painted red, not blue, and he suffers the same injury. Now, is that poor victim not entitled to bring and prosecute a second lawsuit based on the injuries suffered in that second accident because of the existence of the first accident, not according to the defendants? However, the two lawsuits, both in the hypothetical and in this case, involve different acts separated by 6 years, and what happens in one suit will not be dispositive of what is in the other suit. And the only common party in the two suits before the court now is MetroCorp. The fact is, there are no factual issues in common. The standard of care applied to the author, this different author of the first article, whether that was met or not, will not determine whether the author of the second article applied the same standard of care in writing the second article.
Aren't your opponents contending that there were separate authors, but the substance of both articles was pretty much the same?
The substance of both articles, there were some differences. I think in the first article there was a threat by a gun mentioned, also assault with a book or a dictionary of some kind. There were some additional ones. However, under defamation law, one cannot republish or restate a prior defamation with impunity. It gives rise to a separate cause of action for separate damages. I don't believe it can be said at this stage that it was the same injury and that there was the same readership and that nobody knew was affected by it. That's the damage. But the mere fact that the articles are the same, there's no allegation before the court regarding the actionability of those allegations. That was not made in the Pennsylvania suit or this suit.
Well, I thought what the Superior Court was implying, that if your opponents prevailed on the merits in the first suit, then the second suit would be, you know, affected under principles of collateral estoppel.
But my point is, Your Honor, I don't believe that to be the case at all. For example, if it's a negligence standard that has to be met, if the first author was negligent, does that mean that the second author was not, and vice versa? There's just no way to tell.
No, I'm not talking about negligence. I'm talking about the merits of whether or not there really was defamation. If there was no defamation in the first suit, are you saying there still could have been defamation in the second suit?
If Your Honor is saying, are the words actionable as defamation, Certainly that could be raised, that could be collateral estoppel. However, they filed an answer in the Pennsylvania case. They didn't file a motion to dismiss, and they didn't file a motion to dismiss in this case on a 12b6 failure to state a claim. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that it's pretty patent that actions of allegations of physical abuse, of spousal abuse in writing, and indeed in other courts in other states have found allegations of spouse abuse to involve moral turpitude. They're not actionable, or they are defamatory and defamatory per se. This is not a per se case because it's in writing, it's not slander. However, I suggest, Your Honor, that since they did not raise that below, since they did not seek to dismiss on that ground, that is an implied concession that the words are actionable. But apart from that issue, which was not raised by the defendants, there are no factual, that is a legal issue, Your Honor, is raised, but there are no factual issues in common. And, Your Honor, they have the McQuain issue. The problem with McQuain in this case is compounded because it was not merely a stay, but a dismissal outright, without even attending to that legal issue. And the dismissal effectively barred the case from being heard anywhere. It is beyond the statute of limitations in Pennsylvania or anywhere else it could be brought. The defendants say, "Well, that's Mr. Chadwick's tough luck because he made a strategic decision to file in Delaware and not in Pennsylvania." However, we've never seen the McQuain rule used to bar an action or to, as a sword to penalize a plaintiff. And it is, I believe it is a dangerous precedent they are asking the court to set, and an unfair one. Your Honor, that's all I had to say on the McQuain rule, unless the court has any other questions.
I do have a question. Why has the action in Pennsylvania dragged on this long?
There's nothing in the record that explains that, Your Honor. My understanding, going outside the record, is that it is an administrative issue because it's difficult to arrange hearings when someone's in jail.
And that's your client who's in jail?
Yes.
And that's on that contempt matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so one might say that your client, in an indirect way, or maybe even in a less than indirect way, is the reason why that action is not moving forward.
One could blame my client, Your Honor.
You think that would be inappropriate?
It all depends on the perspective. My client believes that he is unjustly in prison. He is working to change that. He has agreed with the other side to have an investigator investigate the validity of his claims. He is saying that he is unable. He maintains to this day that he is unable to comply. Not that he doesn't want to comply, but that he is unable to comply. So does that put him at fault? I guess that's a question of perspective, Your Honor. Now, with that, Your Honor, I'll turn to the long-arm issue. And again, I would like to offer a hypothetical. An individual in Pennsylvania takes anthrax and puts it in a box and mails the box to Delaware. The box is open in Delaware, perhaps by the intended recipient, perhaps by someone inadvertently. The person opening the box gets exposed to the anthrax, suffers the chemical poison, and dies. Now, putting aside issues of criminal liability and jurisdiction, can it be said that there's no jurisdiction in Delaware for a claim for a wrongful death for battery because it was sent from outside of Delaware? In that case, the battery is not complete until the anthrax comes in contact with a human body. That is the tort, the battery. And is the individual shielded from jurisdiction in Delaware because he or she utilized the mail as a medium of transmission instead of delivering the poison personally? Section 3104C3 does not, by its terms, require the defendant to be physically present in Delaware at the time of the commission of the act. It only requires the defendant, personally or through an agent, cause tortious injury in this state by an act or omission in the state. It doesn't say by the performance of an act or omission in the state, only that there be an act in Delaware which leads to tortious injury for which the defendant is liable. And in this case, there was an act in Delaware. The publication in the defamation law sense of defamatory matter, which entered Delaware through the mails and other channels of distribution. And that publication in Delaware was a collective effort. Mrs. Chadwick intentionally gave the interview. It was not an accident. She could have said no. And she did so with the knowledge that Delaware was part of Philadelphia Magazine's distribution area. That is alleged and that is not disputed. Mr. McDougal intentionally wrote the article, presumably for profit, and did so with knowledge or reason to know that the article would be distributed in Delaware. That is also alleged and that is also not disputed. Under defamation law, all of those who participate in the publication, as that term is used in defamation law, are deemed to have committed the act of publication. As such, Mrs. Chadwick and Mr. McDougal are deemed to have committed the intentional act of publication of a defamation in Delaware. And as a consequence of that publication, they caused injury in Delaware, since under defamation law, injury occurs wherever the defamation is published. And it is pure artifice to suggest that they are not responsible because once they turned it over to MetroCorp to publish in Philadelphia Magazine, it was out of their hands. Nor is there any justification for hiding behind the U.S. mail. Had they hired someone, had they hired parcels to come and pick up the articles and deliver to them in Delaware, I don't think this court would have any difficulty in deeming that the parcels was the agent of the defendants for the distribution of the defamation. Why should the postal system be treated any differently? They are both delivery conduits. It's simply the artificial distinction. Now, whether one calls Mrs. Chadwick and Mr. McDougal co-conspirators, what have you, or joint actors, the bottom of the line is that they acted collectively with a common intent to achieve a common goal. And under the law, they are deemed to have performed the act of publication and to meet the criteria of Section C3. Having established that, one has to undertake the due process analysis. Of course, this court has said in Hercules that Section C3 has, with the rest of the long-arm statute, extends to the fullest extent of due process. Here, the defendants committed a tort in Delaware, causing injury in Delaware, and they did so knowingly and intentionally, and to obtain benefit. The authorities we've cited in our brief make it clear that the exercise of personal jurisdiction in Delaware in such circumstances comports with due process, as one who knowingly commits a tort in Delaware can and should be expected to be hailed into a Delaware court to defend his or her action. And most certainly, when one voluntarily and intentionally uses a medium of mass communication to communicate about a third party affecting the reputation of that third party in several jurisdictions, and those articles are now Mr. Chadwick's entree into Delaware, alas, this phrase, one's reputation precedes one, comes into play here. But when they do that in several jurisdictions, it's certain, and knowing that the statement will be published in those jurisdictions, it's fair to subject them to jurisdiction in any of those jurisdictions where the defamation is published. Unless the court has any questions, I will now move on to the libel proof doctrine. I don't have a hypothetical for this. The trial court concluded that Mr. Chadwick is libel proof. He's committed no crime, but has spent a number of years in jail on a finding of civil contempt. Now, it's easy and understandable for members of the bench and the bar to take offense at the idea that one is in contempt of court. What is less clear, however, is that members of the public find that so deeply repugnant that it overshadows any other traits, good or bad, that Mr. Chadwick may possess. According to the defendants, Mr. Chadwick's civil contempt and incarceration condemned him entirely, and he could not be deemed to have any worse reputation if he were discovered to be a rapist, a murderer, a hidden Nazi, a pedophile. According to the defendants, these are all trifles compared to civil contempt in the divorce proceeding. And according to the defendants, jail and civil contempt are more contemptible than allegations of spousal abuse, violence, feticide. This is on its face absurd and unreasonable. Now, in our briefs, we argued that this court should eliminate or at least limit the scope of the libel proof plaintiff doctrine. And while we believe those arguments to be compelling, the truth is the court does not have to go that far to decide this case. The court can simply hold that at this preliminary stage of the proceedings, it cannot be said as a matter of law that Mr. Chadwick's incarceration for civil contempt renders him liable proof, and that such a decision requires further discovery and factual development. Unless the court has any questions, I'm prepared to stand on our briefs and my arguments, subject to any rebuttal I might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Chad Chandler representing FLE's Metro Corp and Christopher McDougall, defendants below. There are a number of issues before the court. And first and foremost is whether the appellant has demonstrated that Judge Carpenter abused his discretion and was clearly wrong in dismissing the second filed Delaware action in favor of the first filed Pennsylvania action under the McWane Doctrine. Another issue obviously before the court is whether the court below properly dismissed the individual defendants for lack of personal jurisdiction. With the court's permission, I would like to use the 15 minutes of the 20 allocated to the appellees to discuss the McWane Doctrine and cede the remaining 5 minutes to my colleague to discuss personal jurisdiction issues as it relates to her client.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Is anybody going to talk about the defamation?
The
libel proof?
If the court has any questions about libel proof, I'm certainly prepared to address those. I don't think we need to even reach those given the McWane Doctrine and its applicability in this case.
When you're addressing the McWane Doctrine, it helped me understand how we got from the court referencing McWane in the bench ruling that it made, and McWane is a stay. And what we have in this case is a dismissal with prejudice. So one way to look at McWane is you defer to the first filed action by simply staying the second filed Delaware action. But in this case, somehow an application of McWane led to a dismissal with prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. If we look at the procedure of the case below, originally we did seek a stay under McWane. The court granted that stay for a period of 6 months and asked the parties to report back on the status of the Pennsylvania action following that six-month period. Nothing having happened, and the plaintiff obviously holding the keys to what occurs in Pennsylvania, the proper course at that time was determined to seek a dismissal. And
what's the authority for that?
Well, under McWane, the court does have the discretion to dismiss or stay. In cases citing McWane and following McWane, do cite that as the standard, although I will grant the court that in most cases a stay is granted rather than a complete dismissal. But in this case, given what has occurred in Pennsylvania and given the fact that this litigant controls what occurs in Pennsylvania and by his own acts is preventing justice from running its course, in this particular case we feel like dismissal is appropriate, as did the court below.
I understand your argument. Were you here for the preceding argument?
Part of it, Your Honor.
Yeah, we seem to have a lot of bad actors involved in our litigation today. But putting that aside, as you know, in the briefing here, there's a suggestion that the statute of limitations has now run in Pennsylvania. So if you were going to look at whether the case should be stayed or dismissed with prejudice, this appears to be the type of case where if you dismiss with prejudice and you're out of court for all time, you would lean towards a stay rather than a dismissal with prejudice.
Well, Your Honor, we view the statute of limitation argument as a red herring. When he filed the Delaware case, the Pennsylvania statute had not yet run. He made a strategic decision to litigate in Delaware rather than and file another case in Pennsylvania where the case really belongs, or even amend the existing allegations.
And I don't want to get off on a tangent on the statute of limitations. And my real question is, as a general proposition, why isn't the better rule to stay the Delaware action and at least perhaps dismiss without prejudice? But here, we're at the other end of the spectrum. And we're not only deferring to the first filed action, this person has been thrown out of court for all time in Delaware. Yeah, and I just tell me why that's the right result.
It might be the right result if there is a certain administrative procedure the court must follow in terms of keeping a case on a docket for a long period of time. I mean, theoretically, this case could be stayed for a very long period of time if Mr. Finger's client does not want to comply with the Pennsylvania court order. And for that reason, if there's an administrative reason for not keeping a case on a docket...
We see that in bankruptcy proceedings all the time. And we just have a tickler system. If someone's in bankruptcy, as you know, in the absence of lifting the automatic stay of bankruptcy, everything stayed indefinitely, and people just write to us, sometimes for years, and they just say the case is still in bankruptcy.
We would obviously prefer a dismissal. If the court thinks that is overstepping the bounds of McWane, we would obviously, our second choice, so to speak, would be an indefinite stay of the Delaware action. However, for reasons I've stated previously, I think we can dismiss the Delaware action based on the actions that this litigant has taken in Pennsylvania.
Well, there's probably been as much written about this issue as anything else in Delaware law, and there's some indication from the cases in LSI, Logic, and Taylor is one that comes to mind, brings back bad memories for me, but one that comes to mind when the Delaware Supreme Court mentioned that courts do have the inherent authority to manage their own docket in deciding whether to dismiss or to stay this case, even under a McWane analysis. Is it conceivable that a trial judge could say, there's so many items on our plate in this court where people are jockeying vigorously for trial dates, and we have a situation here where someone has opted, for reasons best known to himself, to not litigate in a state where he already has the option to litigate, but nevertheless wants to maintain a position on our docket here, in my inherent authority to manage my docket, and in my discretion to dismiss or to stay, I elect to dismiss. Under our case law, is that an objectionable process?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it is a standard of discretion of the trial court to manage its own docket. And in this case, Judge Carpenter felt that the appropriate mechanism was to dismiss this case with prejudice. And for the reason I stated previously, I mean, this could linger on his docket for quite a long time, given the apparent obstinacy.
Well, did he make such a finding that relates to the work pending in the Superior Court and the need for people to find trial dates and people who want to proceed with their case in relation to this one?
Not specifically, Your Honor. However, he did make a finding that he didn't want this case lingering on his docket. And there was three hearings below, I believe, in which McWane was discussed. And I can't recall specifically which hearing that was, but that was mentioned at some point. It may have even been during the first hearing when I was asking for an indefinite stay, and he granted a six-month stay and asked the parties to report back to him. But to answer your question specifically, it is within his discretion to dismiss the case and managing his own docket.
Well, page 5 of his ruling, which is Exhibit B to Mr. Finger's opening brief, and where the court on the record states his reasoning says, to dismiss this litigation as there is pending action in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, that is more appropriate to allow the matter to be heard and is capable of considering that issue, issues that are subject to the litigation. So it appears that he was influenced primarily on deference to the first filed action.
Yes, that's correct. Obviously, you're reading from the order. In a previous order, he did manage to state something about the length of time that this could appear on his docket as well. That is in the record below.
Where is that?
It is, again, there was three hearings dealing with McWane. I believe it may have been in the first hearing when we initially applied for the stay.
Well, don't look for it now. We'll find it.
Sure. Thank you. This has been touched on previously, but I think what we have here is a case where the appellant is attempting to manipulate the courts of our state to circumvent a ruling, if you will, from the Pennsylvania court that has prevented him from pursuing his first filed action because he is in prison and not in compliance with a Pennsylvania court order. On top of this, and further supporting Judge Carpenter's reasoning for an exercise of discretion for dismissing the action, is the fact that this case has absolutely no relationship to Delaware. Granted, that is not a required analysis under McWane, but it is a factor that was considered by the McWane court itself and a few others interpreting McWane. And in this case, the only connection that the appellant can point to with respect to this litigation in Delaware is the fact that for a brief period of time, he came to the state in the mid-1990s in order to evade Pennsylvania authorities who were seeking his capture as a result of violation of the contempt order. So this is another factor that we feel supports the exercise of Judge Carpenter's discretion, dismissing the action. And as far as the legal principles under McWane, I'm sure the court is well familiar with those, and we addressed those in our brief. And I would like to just briefly go over those and demonstrate how they apply. First of all, there must be a prior action pending in another jurisdiction. Here, there is a prior action. It's pending in Pennsylvania. Chadwick, a lawyer by trade himself, made the strategic decision to file the first filed action in Delaware. Not Metro. Chadwick chose that form. Second, the court where the
You just said the first filed action in Delaware. You meant in Pennsylvania?
Did I misspeak?
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Fine.
It was in Pennsylvania.
Just want to make sure.
Yes, it was the first filed action in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Second, under McWane, the court must be capable, and capability is a key, of promptly and completely resolving the first filed action. In this case, the Pennsylvania court is certainly capable of resolving the first filed action. Chadwick will not allow justice to run its course by refusing to comply with the order and remaining in jail. On top of this, Chadwick has argued again today that, well, he may not be able to comply with the Pennsylvania court order. Well, several courts have considered that, state and federal, including the Third Circuit, and they've all found that Chadwick does have the present ability to comply with that order. So Chadwick is collaterally stopped from making that argument here because it's already been decided by numerous courts. In addition, in the Pennsylvania action, as my friend Mr. Finger noted, Chadwick filed a complaint in Pennsylvania. Metro answered the complaint. That's undisputed. It's also undisputed that Metro did not seek to stay the Pennsylvania action. At this point, it is the burden of Mr. Chadwick to come forward with some credible evidence to demonstrate why the Pennsylvania action is not proceeding. The only logical inference is that it's not proceeding because he remains in jail, and I think Mr. Finger sort of acknowledged that today. On top of that, if you look at the docket sheet in Pennsylvania, there's absolutely no action taken by Mr. Chadwick to attempt to lift that stay. He's apparently made a strategic decision to let the case languish in Pennsylvania and instead come to our courts here to litigate what is essentially the same claim. In terms of his argument about not being able to obtain complete relief, this again hinges on the fact that we are dealing with basically the same action in two different jurisdictions. Granted, there are different articles, but if the court looks at those articles, looks at the complaints, which there are in Pennsylvania and Delaware, it's quickly evident that the actions are essentially the same, seeking the same relief for damages to Chadwick's reputation.
Well, how do you respond to Mr. Finger's argument that he might have the same corporation with a new author, but the republication, or basically repeating the content of the first article a second time several years later, is a separate cause of action that should stand alone and be tried in Delaware?
Addressing the first part of your question first, McWane has been interpreted by several courts to just require substantial or functional identity between the parties and the issues. And here we do have substantial or functional identity, both in terms of the parties and the issues. Metro Corp is obviously a major defendant in both actions. They're the publisher. Without Metro, you don't have a Pennsylvania action and you don't have a Delaware action. In terms of not being able to be afforded complete relief because of maybe a different cause of action, again, we think it is the same cause of action. But even going beyond that, we have to look at the fact, again, that Chadwick made a strategic decision to file the second claims in Delaware. He could have and should have filed them in Pennsylvania, and he must live with the consequences of that decision. Particularly under McWane, and primary rationale is principles of comity, and I think that cannot be understated in this case. In light of this, it should be kept in mind that if Chadwick is permitted to pursue his second filed suit in Delaware. He, in effect, will be doing an end-around on the Pennsylvania court in the order they have established. And unlike Delaware, Pennsylvania has a vested interest in litigating this dispute. All of the key facts occurred in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania should not be frustrated from litigating that dispute by whatever occurs here in Delaware.
Help me understand how he does an end-around. If he can't litigate successfully in Pennsylvania while he's incarcerated, why is he going to be able to pursue the Delaware litigation more successfully while he remains incarcerated?
What I meant by an end-around, Your Honor, is that he is not being permitted to litigate in Pennsylvania because he's not in compliance with the court order and remains in jail. And in order to escape that procedural aspect of the Pennsylvania case, he's come to Delaware to evade that. And that's what I mean by principles of comity, in that we're allowing...
Well, no one said he can't litigate because he's in jail. It's just logistically difficult to have inmates show up in court proceedings. Isn't that correct?
There's really not an established record as to why the Pennsylvania court is not proceeding, but that very well could be a reason. I see that I'm out of time, and unless the court has any further questions, I will concede to Ms. James.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Jennifer Dufault James, and I am here arguing on behalf of appellee defendant below, Barbara Applegate. The Superior Court, the court below, determined that there was no jurisdiction over Ms. Applegate in Delaware in this case, and accordingly dismissed the case as to Ms. Applegate. And that decision was correct under the law of Delaware and should be affirmed. The court below engaged in the first part of the two-part jurisdictional analysis in Delaware, that is, first determining whether or not the Delaware long-arm statute entitles the Delaware courts to exercise jurisdiction over a non-resident defendant. That first step of the mandatory two-step process must be satisfied before the court proceeds to the second step, and that is the question of whether or not the exercise of personal jurisdiction satisfies federal constitutional due process considerations. The court below did not reach the due process analysis because it determined, we submit correctly, that the long-arm statute in Delaware did not confer jurisdiction and therefore did not have to reach due process. We submit that as the case here, although I am prepared to address both the statutory and due process aspects of the jurisdictional argument as to Ms. Applegate. We do, however, have to start with the statute, and there we start with the language of the statute. Plaintiff asserts that jurisdiction is proper over Ms. Applegate under section 3104C3. That section specifically requires not only a tortious injury in the state of Delaware, but separately enumerates that it must be caused by an act or omission, but here we're talking about an act in this state. So it has two separate components within 3104C3, that is a tortious injury caused by an act, both the injury and the act being separate things that must occur in the state. Here, as a matter of undisputed record, and regardless of how generously the allegations in the complaint and the affidavits are to be read or construed, there is no act whatsoever by Ms. Applegate, who is a resident of Maine, in the state of Delaware. No act whatsoever. And right there, the statute should stop the jurisdictional claim cold and not allow the courts to require jurisdiction or require Ms. Applegate to have to defend in Delaware in a case where she committed no act in Delaware.
Let's assume she's the source of the story. And is it your contention that if you give an interview to a national publication, you only committed the act in the state where you gave the interview, even if you know you're giving it to a publication that will be distributed nationally?
It would depend, I think, on where the interview was given and the facts of the interview. If we bring it to this case, the interview did not involve at all the state where the act needs to take place, and that is Delaware. This is not a case where the call was in Delaware.
I'm just trying to help you help me understand the law. Let's suppose you're talking to People magazine, and you talk to People magazine in Chicago, and you know that People magazine goes to all 50 states, and you give this interview, is it your position that you could only be sued in Chicago?
It is our position that under the Delaware long-arm statute, that factual scenario would not be an act, not constitute an act in Delaware. I think that the court's question maybe directs it more toward the kind of contacts that are necessary for due process analysis. And if you reach the due process analysis, I would say that without having any kind of minimum contacts with the state and no control over the publication, that person would not have the kind of purposeful availment that's required for a due process, for satisfying due process. Here, it is very important for that Ms. Applegate is the source. She is not by any means the publisher. She is not even the reporter. She is someone who spoke to a reporter who is an independent contractor who then wrote an article that was then edited, published, and distributed by another entity, being MetroCorp, a corporate publisher. If someone in Ms. Applegate's position as a source is subject to jurisdiction in all 50 states just by speaking to a reporter whose words may or may not be ultimately picked up and put into a publication in all 50 states, then any source anywhere in the country, whenever they give any kind of statement to the press in any location, is potentially subject to jurisdiction elsewhere besides where they made the statement and where they reasonably were giving the interview or knew that the interviewer was located. So that expands the concept of due process beyond anything that any case has done before. And it also, I think, makes us mindful of the fact that there are First Amendment overtones in this case. We're very mindful that we have to pay attention to the language of the Delaware statute, and that is the first hurdle. There are First Amendment overtones here, though, because when we're talking about subjecting someone to jurisdiction based solely on their speech, on protected speech, then we need to be aware that certain kinds of limitations, certain kinds of extensions, actually, of jurisdiction could trample on First Amendment rights, and that's why that's important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can just indicate to us where we would find it in the record.
Sure. So the hearing that occurred on February 24, 2003.
That's in response to Justice Holland's question. Thank you very much for that information. Mr. Finger?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, going in reverse order, Ms. Solano said brought up First Amendment overtones relating to long-arm jurisdiction. The U.S. Supreme Court, and I don't recall if it's either Keaton versus Hustler or Calder versus Jones, rejected that argument, said there's no First Amendment issue in dealing with jurisdiction. It is a 14th Amendment due process analysis, and the First Amendment plays no role. Also, just a quick factual point in response to Ms. Solano's argument. Mrs. Chadwick, in this case, was a source for a second time. She was not an innocent, not an accident. It was intentional. And in that case, I think, Your Honor, that she is not limited to Mass Maine or wherever she was when she gave her interview. Responding to a question that Mr. Chief Justice Steele asked about administrative convenience and controlling the dockets, I will not be presumptuous to suggest I know any more about administering cases than Your Honors. However, I would suggest that where a case cannot be brought elsewhere and where it is not seeking a trial and is not imposing anything on the court because it's being stayed, I do not know how that would interfere with the courts so as to warrant dismissal and denial of a remedy at all. I suggest that it would be inappropriate. Mr. Chandler said that there's no connection in this case to Mr. Chadwick has no connection to Delaware. If he didn't before, he did when the article got distributed in Delaware. As I said, one's reputation precedes one, and that is now how readers in Delaware know Mr. Chadwick. Mr. Chandler also said that Mr. Chadwick is collaterally stopped from arguing that he is unable to comply. Certainly, I agree with Mr. Chandler that those cases make that finding. However, I would also point out to the court that the divorce court in Pennsylvania has entered an order, which is Exhibit A, B, or C to our opening brief, to allow an investigation of the truth of that assertion. If this was a done deal, the judge would not have required that or allowed that, because it would determine, the courts have said, he's capable to comply, that's it. Mr. Chandler says there's substantial identity of issues. Justice Holland has pointed out the legal issue. Again, no one has pointed to any factual issues between the two cases that are common. And I think basically what Mr. Chandler is arguing is that he should not be permitted, Mr. Chadwick should not be permitted to litigate in Delaware because he's not permitted to litigate in Pennsylvania. Mr. Chadwick is in jail in Delaware. He's in Pennsylvania for his reasons. He, as I said in the brief, that is his punishment of contempt. Denial of litigation rights was not part of that contempt order, and that should not be a consideration in Your Honor's ruling. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement, and we stand adjourned.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable.